thanks for joining us. I'm Tamara Keith of NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's out for a voice treatment. Already this year, hundreds of thousands of people have fled war-torn Syria and other nations in the Middle East and North Africa. Europe is their primary destination. Hungary and Austria have become the latest pressure points. In Budapest yesterday, Hungarian authorities stopped hundreds of migrants hoping to get to Germany. Austria has toughened border controls. Joining me in the studio to talk about Europe's escalating migrant crisis, we have Dimitrios Papadimitriou of the Migration Policy Institute of Europe and Francis Burwell, a Europe analyst with the Atlantic Council. Thanks for joining us. And first, though, joining us by phone from Budapest is Andrew Byrne of the Financial Times. Hi, Andrew.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good. Can you, you're reporting there. What is it like? What is the situation?
Well, yeah, so just maybe to start by giving your listeners some background, they may be wondering why it is that Hungary has become this flashpoint in this migrant crisis. And it's simply because many of the thousands of Syrian and Afghan refugees and other migrants coming to Europe have chosen to enter the European Union at Hungary. It's the European Union's gateway country. They travel overland through the Balkans and enter into Hungary. And almost all of the ones that I've met, all of the migrants and refugees, tell me that their ultimate destination is Germany. Now, Hungary has come in for some criticism for its approach to this crisis. It has built a razor wire fence on the border, and the Prime Minister has said that migration poses a threat to European civilization. But the situation really escalated here on Monday when some of the 3,000 migrants that have been arriving here each day had gathered at Budapest's main Keleti station. Now, this is the central station in the city.
The train station there.
That's right. And if you can imagine, it's been turned into a kind of a makeshift refugee camp. Now, until now, the Hungarian authorities had prevented the passengers from boarding trains unless they had a valid EU passport. And on Monday, there appeared to be a temporary relapse in that rule. Police were simply overwhelmed by migrants, and an estimated 3,500 made it onto trains to Austria and Germany. Now, this prompted a clampdown on Tuesday when the station was evacuated and hundreds of migrants were pushed outside, prompting angry protests. The latest is that those protests are continuing. The migrants still want to get to Germany, and they're camped outside the station demanding to be allowed inside.
And we should say that they've been through a lot by the time they get to that point.
That's right. I mean, many of the migrants that I spoke to, and they come from places like Aleppo or Idlib that are often occupied by Islamic militants. They left their homes 1 month, maybe 2 or 3 months ago, and traveled overland by foot. Some of them are mostly young men, but there's also quite a lot of families with young children. They, if they came up through the Balkans, many of them told me that they experienced theft by police and by armed bandits on the streets, and then they oftentimes had to crawl through this new razor wire fence on the border with Hungary to enter Hungary. Now, the trouble for many of them is that it seems to be, in spite of this fence, it seems to be easier to arrive in Hungary than to leave it. And almost all of them tell me that they really don't wish to remain here. They oftentimes have family in Germany or Sweden. They think they have a chance of a better life there, and that's their ultimate destination.
This is sort of baffling, then, that they get to Hungary and then they're stuck in Hungary, and it sounds like Hungary doesn't really want them either.
Yes, it's sort of a paradoxical situation. The government here has defended itself from what it sees as unfair criticism by other European governments, who said that it has taken, the French government described Hungary's approach to the migrant crisis as scandalous by building this fence and by refusing to participate in an EU plan to share out refugees among member states. So the government, on the one hand, is quite alarmed by and quite hostile to even the idea of immigration. But on the other hand, it says that it has a responsibility as an EU border state. It has a responsibility to protect the EU's external borders, to apply EU asylum rules, which require them to register and process asylum seekers, and to prevent them from traveling on to other EU countries unless they have passports or visas. And of course, if you're a Syrian who left Aleppo, you almost certainly do not have a passport or valid visa.
And meanwhile, Germany is saying we'll take them, or at least some of them, but they can't get to Germany, or they're basically in some sort of terminal situation at the train terminal.
Yeah, they're stuck in a kind of a limbo situation here. Now, under EU rules, the so-called Dublin III rules, the first EU country in which an asylum seeker arrives is supposed to process that asylum seeker's claim for refugee status, and that country bears the responsibility for that claim. Now, Germany, and for that reason many migrants don't wish to apply for asylum here in Hungary, but are stopped by authorities. Now, the Hungarian government here, in a sense, indirectly, has blamed Germany for causing the chaotic scenes at the train station on Monday, because the German government said its officials would be more flexible in assessing the asylum claims of Syrians who may have already arrived in an EU country previously. They said they would allow them to remain if they eventually got to Germany. And from the point of view of Hungary and Austria, which is another transit country, this, in a sense, they say, many officials say, added to the kind of confusing situation and the swirling rumours around the train station at the start of this week. And that has only added to the frustration of the migrants I spoke to, who really feel they're in an intolerable situation at the station, and really they just want to be allowed to leave.
Now, there's also an issue with trafficking. Late last week, we heard about a truck where something like 70 migrants or maybe more were found dead. How is trafficking playing in all of this? Where does it fit into the
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, that incident in Austria was obviously a very tragic incident, and in which 71 people, including 8 women and 4 children, who had been put into a refrigerated truck and driven from Budapest to Austria. Now, remember, again, these migrants aren't generally allowed on the train, so oftentimes they seek out covert ways of reaching Germany through traveling in trucks or in the back of cars. Unfortunately, there were 71 people crammed into a very small truck, and they suffocated, and the truck was found abandoned. Now, the police in Hungary have arrested 5 suspects in connection with that case. They say it's a Hungarian and Bulgarian human trafficking ring, and the main suspect was a Bulgarian man of Lebanese descent. It's hard to say exactly how many human traffickers are in operation, what proportion of irregular migration is being channeled or directed by human traffickers. It's a criminal underworld that's rather murky, it's rather informal, and of course, these people operate without wishing to be detected. I mean, it's well known that for many years these trafficking rings have been operating in the Balkans, in several non-EU states as well as EU states. And the response now since that tragic event on Tuesday has been further to be greater police checks on Western-bound trucks leaving Hungary. And the Austrian police have been very thorough in examining trucks on the highways from Hungary. But that has had the side effect of causing, you know, 20-mile-long tailbacks on these highways. And, of course,
tailbacks, you know, traffic jams.
Traffic jams running the whole length of highways towards Germany and Austria. And, of course, you know, a founding principle of the European Union's so-called Schengen zone is that you should have border-free travel within the EU. And so these checks, these police controls, appear to be undermining this very treasured and very cherished principle of a borderless European Union.
Are the traffickers exploiting a situation, or are they making the situation worse, or both?
I suppose it's a question of both. I mean, on the one hand, you have these very strict rules, and the Hungarian government insists they're simply applying the rules as they are, and they won't allow migrants to travel onto these trains. But if you can imagine, if you're a Syrian or an Afghan person who perhaps sold everything you owned and traveled through quite trying circumstances to reach Europe, you're not really going to take no for an answer. You're going to seek other ways and means of getting to Germany, for instance, if that's your desired destination. And that's where these traffickers step in. Many of the migrants I spoke to at the station said that if the train station was not going to be open to them, if they couldn't get on these trains to Germany, they would try and seek out what they called mafia to take them in covert means. So, you know, this problem of human trafficking is not new. Human traffickers have been operating in the region for some time. But I think now with this unprecedented migrant crisis, and there were 50,000 migrants entering Hungary last month alone, they've reached a newfound prominence, and it's certainly an infamous one.
And they have a whole lot more business, I guess. Andrew Byrne, thank you so much. Andrew Byrne is a reporter in Budapest at the moment with the Financial Times. Coming up, more of our conversation about the migrant crisis in Europe. And also, we'll take your calls here on the Diane Rehm Show.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. I'm Tamara Keith, sitting in for Diane Rehm, and we are talking about the migrant crisis in Europe. And we want to take your calls and your questions. The number to call is 1-800-433-8850. You can send us an email to drshow@wamu.org or join us on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is at DR Show. And here in the studio with us is Fran Burwell of the Atlantic Council and Dimitri Papadimitriou with the Migration Policy Institute Europe. And Dimitri, we just listened to a on-the-ground report about what's been happening there. I don't even know exactly where to start. This has obviously hit a crisis point, but it's been building.
Yes, it has been, and it has actually gone beyond just a crisis. I'm fairly convinced by now that this is a far more important, almost existential crisis for the EU and the systems of states and the Commission and the institutions that they have created over the last 50 or 65 years or whatever, much more so, for instance, than the crisis over the euro. Because this goes fundamentally at the heart of what societies are made of. It is fundamentally going to the issue of rules, who qualifies, who doesn't. It goes to questioning again things that are signal achievements of the European Union, which is the Schengen Accord, the elimination of internal border, but we forget that the grand bargain there between eliminating the internal borders to harden external borders. And what we're seeing as a result of this crisis is the vanishing of at least the Mediterranean external borders of Europe right in front of our eyes. So this is really as fundamental an issue because the public is losing trust in their own institutions, their own governments, but far more broadly, the European Commission and the institutions, as they call them.
Fran, what are your thoughts on what this means for the European Union?
Well, I agree with what Dimitri has just said. I do think that this is far more than an immigration crisis. This is an integration crisis. Even if the flows stopped right now, which is not going to happen. We would have a very serious issue in Europe in terms of the integration of an increasingly diverse population. Europe has been diversifying for quite some time. Anyone who goes to a major European city is aware of the very different ethnic groups that have arrived in Europe over the years. But this is a whole new level. They have already this year gone well over a doubling of the same January to July period in terms of who has arrived. 340,000 so far this year, 120-something thousand during the same period last year. So, and there's no sign that it's going to stop. The only thing I think that European leaders can hope for is that some of the traveling will stop as the winter closes in. So they now have to deal with how to make societies that are more diverse feel that that diversity is legitimate. As Demetrius said, this really does bring in a question of legitimacy and a question of how Europe will cope with this. And we're seeing some very noisy arguments being played out in public between the Germans and others about burden sharing. This is one of the big consequences, is that we have countries with different attitudes towards immigration, different attitudes towards refugees because of their histories. And now they have to, and different financial situations. I think, you know, Greece is the primary recipient, but everybody acknowledges that Greece does not have the...
They're not equipped.
They're not just equipped to do this, no.
They're struggling with their own situation.
That's
right.
That's right. That's right.
Dimitri.
Yes, this is an excellent point. And I think for an American audience who have to understand the meaning of integration in Europe, here we bring in refugees. After they have been fully vetted, et cetera, we give them a couple of dollars, literally, and then we try to place them in the labor market. I should say they try to find a place for themselves in the labor market. That's not how things work in much of Europe. These are organized societies. Employers expect to hire people who are already trained. There is a system for actually getting mentorships and apprenticeships and things like that, all of which take time, which is fine if you were getting 10, the other point that I mentioned, 10,000 or 20,000 per year. But
you're getting hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands. So what will happen next? And in the calculation that the European Union and member states must make about the costs of this, the financial costs of this, I would have imagined that by now, Europe would be thinking about approaches beyond the kinds of things that they're doing. In other words, they're doing a great job of saying, you know, come in, we'll protect you, we'll try to treat you right, you make it to the desired destination, okay? But we're doing nothing about all of these other places from which these people come, or the places through which they get here. I know that's difficult, and it's very expensive, but when you put all of these numbers together about the costs for integration, et cetera, we ought to be thinking much more strategically about these issues.
Well, and I think that it's not just about jobs or money. There's also sort of the societal fabric, and Europe has had a sort of a mixed record of welcoming people from outside.
Right. Fran. Just a couple of points. I would say that in April and June, the EU, through various institutions, did decide that it would undertake a much more assertive role in trying to get some of the origin countries to keep people there, to restrain the flows. Unfortunately, one of the countries they wanted to deal with was Libya, which now has either no government or two governments or however you want. So who do you talk to? And another one is Syria, and there's no sign of Syria abating. We also have Iraq and Afghan refugees showing up. And so it's going to be extremely difficult to work with these countries to stop the flow of refugees. I would also say, in terms of European societies, here in the United States, we tell ourselves we're an immigration country.
We're a country of immigrants.
Exactly.
I don't know how many times we tell ourselves
exactly.
That.
And no matter what the actual realities were of how well the Irish were received at first, you know, we're all from someplace else except the Native Americans. In Europe, that is not what they tell themselves about themselves. And so there has been a real uptick in kind of right-wing politics particularly, but among those who are, shall we say, discouraged by their governments and feel alienated from the political system, this crisis is only feeding the flames of that particular fire, and it's fodder for governments, and I would put the Hungarian government in this category, who seek to use anti-immigrant feeling to gain more support among their populace.
I want to read an email that we got from Judy in New York City. She says, the tragedy across the Middle East has turned into a human crisis, but many countries simply cannot accept people for true and good reasons, financial, the infrastructure to house and care for migrants. And she says her question is whether the EU has a cap number in mind, because she says there's no indication the exodus is abating. And then what?
I don't know how you would enforce a cap number. I have not heard of a cap number being talked about, but how would you stop these people from coming? The EU is now, and the Italian government did this relatively effectively before, sending ships out and retrieving people who are dying. Do you turn them away? They found 50 people asphyxiated in the hull of a ship the other day. So it's not just people like this tragic event that happened on the highway in the truck with the 71 people who died. I would say also that at least in some countries in Europe, and Germany is a leader in this, there is a real feeling that because of the experience of the Second World War, that Europe should be a place for refugees, that refugees should not be turned away. Now, that is not shared by all the countries, but at least in the ethos of the European Union, I think that is held.
I want to turn to the phone now, and on the line we have from Brussels, David O'Sullivan. He's the EU ambassador to the U.S. Welcome, David.
Hi, Diane. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
I'm actually not Diane. A great disappointment to our listeners. I'm Tamara Keith from NPR, filling in for Diane. She's out for a voice treatment. But thank you so much for being on the Diane Rehm Show.
Okay. Thank you.
Are you getting any sense that European Union leaders are ready to jump into action on this, or are they already?
No, I think we have already been extremely active. I mean, firstly, I'd like to pick up on what Fran just said. You know, the first thing here is that this is a massive humanitarian tragedy. It started in the Mediterranean, where we have now seen enormous generosity, both at sea and on land in Italy and Greece, with people welcoming into their homes and their official buildings, schools, and makeshift shelters for all the people landing in extremely difficult circumstances, and trying to minimize the loss of life of people being sent to sea in unshipworthy vessels. Equally, the tragedy of people suffocating in vehicles on land. And we have really seen a lot of outpouring of humanitarian responses. You saw in Germany on Saturday at all the football matches, people holding up signs saying, welcome refugees. So I think one point I would send is that there is a huge sense in Europe of responsibility towards these refugees. We know they are coming from situations of extreme difficulty. It is politically difficult. It is as politically contentious in Europe as, frankly, the debate about immigration sometimes is in the United States. And there are differing views. But the Commission is extremely active. There's a fact-finding missions going on now in Greece, in Austria, in Germany. President Juncker will make a major speech on this on the 9th of September, and there will be a special meeting of ministers concerned with immigration on the 14th, and I'm quite sure the Commission will come forward with further proposals as to how we can address this, both respecting our international obligations, avoiding dealing with the humanitarian aspect, but also looking forward to the medium term. We are a continent which actually needs immigrants, and we have to find a way of helping legal migration take place in much healthier and safer conditions than what is happening now.
And it should be pointed out that many of these refugees are, in fact, highly skilled people coming from desperate situations.
Absolutely, and in one small way, not that one would ever wish that this crisis was happening in the way in which it is happening, this also does represent an opportunity, both for the people concerned and for the European economy in the medium term. But I emphasize the first thing is to try and get a control on the situation, make sure that people are being treated correctly, that we are fully respecting our international obligations for asylum seekers and the conditions under which they have to be received, but also making sure that the countries who are in the front line here, Italy, Greece in the Mediterranean, Hungary, Austria, through the Western Balkans stream, are not left alone to deal with this. This is a pan-European problem. We need solidarity from all European countries, financial assistance, but also a willingness from other European countries to help take some of these refugees so that the full burden does not fall on those who are in the front line.
I'm Tamara Keith of NPR, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Ambassador, is there emergency funding now to sort of help with that? Are there things
yes,
like
indeed.
That happening?
We have some 3 billion euros for an asylum and migration fund, which is being used to provide assistance to the frontline states to help them cope better with these sudden influxes, because I heard you say earlier that someone had commented that there is an immediate short-term problem of logistics, of physical capacity to try and deal with this unprecedented increase in the numbers, and the Commission is actively working with Member States to see how we can provide them with support and assistance to cope with the sudden influx which we've witnessed in recent weeks. But also, I emphasize, we need to work in the medium term to address this problem, because this is not a problem that's going to go away quickly. As we know, the situations which are at the origin of this, whether it's the conflict in Syria, whether it's the breakdown in countries like Eritrea or Somalia, the breakdown of law and order in Libya. We will work hard to try and fix these political problems, but there isn't going to be a quick fix. So we're going to have to live with this problem probably for many years to come.
In terms of Europe and the sort of internal politics, the principle of the European Union of free flow within borders, do you agree that that could be threatened by this if people lose faith, or if some countries handle it differently than other countries?
Well, I think we should not confuse the two things. There is freedom of movement for European citizens within the European Union, which is a legal right. Refugees and asylum seekers do not have such a legal entitlement until such time as they are actually officially classified as legally resident asylum seekers or refugees. So these are two separate issues. But I do agree with you that this issue is putting some stresses and strains on a sense of solidarity across the European Union, and this is where political leadership is needed. I think Chancellor Merkel has been extremely outspoken. Other European leaders, President Juncker, the President of the Commission, I think have said that this has to be viewed as a Europe-wide problem, and the countries who are in the front line cannot be left to deal with this on their own.
Is there anything that the U.S. or other countries outside of Europe should be doing?
Well, I think we work very closely with the United States in trying to address the root issues which are giving rise to this massive refugee problem. Never forget that Syria, the conflict in Syria, is actually the largest humanitarian crisis the world has seen in living memory. And while we in Europe have some problems with the numbers of migrants, neighboring countries such as Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan are bearing the brunt and seeing much, much bigger numbers. And by the way, the European Union is one of the biggest donors of humanitarian aid directly to those countries to help them cope with even bigger influxes of migrants. So we do need to try and find political solutions to what is happening in Syria. We need to try and establish a functioning government in Libya. As you know, the European Union is also putting together a naval force to try to address the issue of the smugglers, who are the people who exploit the misery of these refugees in putting them out to sea in unseaworthy vessels. And I know that the United States has promised to be very cooperative in helping us also gain the necessary international recognition at the United Nations for what that naval force will need to do. So we're very happy with the excellent cooperation we have with the United States, and I think we see very much eye to eye on many of these conflicts which are at the origin of this refugee crisis.
Ambassador O'Sullivan, thank you very much for joining us. He joined us by phone from Brussels. David O'Sullivan, the EU ambassador to the U.S. Coming up, your calls and questions for our panel. Please stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm Tamara Keith of NPR, sitting in for Diane Rehm. And just before we went to the break, we heard from David O'Sullivan, the EU ambassador to the United States, talking about the crisis of migrants and refugees in Europe. And I want to turn to our guests in the studio now and just get their reaction to what he was saying. Frances Burwell is with the Atlantic Council. Fran?
So I think that Ambassador Sullivan did, as most ambassadors would do, present a very cogent and positive, forward-looking review of what the EU is doing. And I think that there is a lot that the EU is doing to try and attempt to stem the flow of asylum seekers and of these people who are showing up. But this is a real crisis for Europe, and I am struck by the fact that the crisis meeting will be held in 2 weeks, whereas during the Greek crisis, we tended to see European leaders meet almost at the drop of a hat at an amazingly speedy rate when they needed to do this. The EU does make decisions when confronted with a crisis, but it often requires a crisis in order to make that decision. And so I am a little concerned that this is going on too long and that we will see more anti-immigrant feeling arise, particularly in certain countries, and more discussions, as Ambassador O'Sullivan pointed out, about burden sharing between the different countries. He mentioned Angela Merkel, and she has taken a leading role, and she has spoken out in ways that one does not normally expect of Chancellor Merkel, who is a very conservative, little c politician, very cautious in her statements, and she has been way ahead of many of her public. And we need to see more of that by more European leaders, and not just those who are part of the European institutions, but by more national leaders. And we're not seeing it very often.
I want to turn to the email real quick, if that's all right. And Mike in Keller, Texas, writes, can someone explain the difference between migrants and refugees? I also, though, want to turn to the phones because we have a call related to that topic. Sinisha from Dallas, Texas. Is that how you pronounce your name?
Yes, Sinisha. That's correct.
Sinisha. What's your question?
Well, this is really a personal issue as far as I'm concerned. I was born and raised in Bosnia and Herzegovina, and I refuged during a conflict in the 90s. Migrants and refugees are two different things. And it's rather upsetting when I hear all the authorities or experts, so to say, that are using the term migrants, when in better in fact, these people are actually refugees. I would just like to say that, you know, I would love for somebody to actually go and see the conditions or try to feel what these people are going through in order to refuge from a war-disturbed area into another one that's peaceful. And the UN definition clearly spells out that a refugee is, as a matter of fact, a person that's refuging or leaving the war-disturbed area in order to obtain a better life elsewhere, usually in a third country.
I really appreciate your call. And Demetrios Papadimitriou with the Migration Policy Institute of Europe, what are your thoughts on this? I imagine you have a lot of thoughts on this.
Yes, a few. Certainly, these are mixed flows. Every flow is a mixed flow, and it includes people who would likely qualify for refugee status, which is at the end of a determination process, and an awful lot of people whom in Europe they call economic migrants. migrants. And in the United States, we have other names, unauthorized, undocumented, illegal, etc., etc. At this state, at this point in time, most people estimate that as many as 40+% of the total flow are economic migrants. This is something that needs to be handled. This is the issue, one of many issues that the European member states, but also the Commission, are not really doing as many things as they ought to be doing in order to separate the one class of people from the other class of people. And refugees, we all know the definition, not only in the universal, the UN Convention on Refugees, but also the European Social and Human Rights Convention, which goes beyond the convention. Those people will need to be protected, no doubt about it. But you have to make some decisions. You have to adjudicate claim. You have to separate the groups. And those people who are economic migrants, yes, they're there to try to create better conditions for themselves, et cetera, and their families. Those people don't belong there, particularly during a time of crisis, because you have to be able to persuade your public that this extraordinary grant of protecting people is not being taken advantage of. So this is a difficult issue. It must be handled. They're not handling it.
What word should we be using right now in this conversation?
Asylum seekers or mixed flows.
Greg in Wells, Maine, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for taking my call. You know, I happen to be a Europhile, and I love the EU, but the EU just got way too big. And that's part of the problem. You have 25-plus countries trying to come to a consensus, which is extremely difficult. And then the other thing, too, is the people that are leaving and departing are just the kind of people that the country needs to get them back on their feet. And the U.S. has a lot to blame in this situation with all the nation building that they've done in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in Libya. So it's we were the U.S. was a lot of the cause of the problem.
Greg, thank you. Thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. Do you guys have an answer to that?
Well, I think that the EU made a strategic decision. This is on the size of the EU and the number of countries. They made a strategic decision after the end of the Cold War that the countries that had come out from communism and behind the Iron Curtain would be better off within the EU. And they have been a major transformational force for these countries. That said, there are two issues, and I would say that before every enlargement of the EU, those of us who follow the EU are always worried that they'll be unable to make decisions. And they somehow seem to make as many decisions as they made before. But this particular issue, first off, if you can imagine a situation where we would bring together the governors of the concerned states when looking, you know, Texas, California, Arizona, et cetera, and then some of the northern states that might be recipients of migrant flows, and put them in a room and ask them to make a decision about how to handle these flows, you can imagine how difficult it would be for them with no central authority, no federal government. And that's essentially the situation that the EU finds itself in. I also do think that we have a little bit of a cultural issue between some of the new countries who, after the Second World War, did not go through the same historical learning process, if you will, and therefore may not share some of the attitudes towards refugees and that they should be helped. Even in Germany itself, you can see this where you've seen protests in what was former East Germany. And most of the protests have taken part there. And in the western part of Germany, you have a very different, a very protective attitude towards those who are seen as genuine refugees. It's not a hard and fast geographical division, but most of the protests we have seen have been, and violent demonstrations have been, in the old Eastern Länder.
We have some questions coming in over email about the potential U.S. role in this. An email from Libby in North Carolina. She asks, what is the United States doing to help these unfortunate people? Why aren't we loading jumbo jets in Budapest every day and bringing some listeners here? Also, Kevin in Hagerstown says, please tell the listeners how many of these migrants trying to enter Europe have been brought to America. He says he's heard widely varying figures, but nothing definitive. Please enlighten us, he says.
Well, on the issue of Syrian refugees, which is presumably what it is that these folks
are thinking about.
We have been taking barely a trickle of refugees from Syria. And that has everything to do with the way the protocols that we have that try to make sure that we don't bring in terrorists. So it takes a long time for us to bring somebody from over there over here. The way that we bring refugees into the United States, we resettle them, but all of the vetting, all of the preparation, et cetera, has happened at refugee camps. So this is not an easy thing for us to say we'll take 15,000 tomorrow. And there is something else that is at play here. The United States may, you know, have some role in all of this, and we're trying to change policy with regard to Syria, et cetera, et cetera. But by and large, we're in a position where we feel that all crises, humanitarian or migration crises, are regional affairs. This is Europe's problem. When we had our crisis last year with unaccompanied minors
along the U.S.-Mexico
along the
border,
U.S.-Mexico border or other
America.
Kinds of things,
yeah.
Boats coming here 20-some years ago directly from China and what have you, you know, the Europeans didn't say, can we help? Nor did we ask for their help. The United States will help, I'm convinced, if the Europeans show resolve, a plan, strategic plan, that actually over time reduces the numbers of people who are leaving the areas around Syria. And if I can add one more thing, this isn't about trying to sort of create a government in Libya or solve Syria. This is not going to happen.
That doesn't seem like something that's going to be solved overnight.
Overnight.
No. Or so anytime soon.
We ought to put much more effort into helping refugees in what we call the first asylum countries. Almost 90% of all Syrians are found in three places, Lebanon, Jordan, and Turkey. We are taking, let's say by the end of the year, if these numbers keep doubling, we may take as many as whatever, 700,000 or 800,000 Syrians. So we ought to put an awful lot more eggs in that basket, create opportunities for people to actually see, get education for their children, create some training programs, have European employers come in and begin to say, okay, you know, we need car mechanics. You're a car mechanic, here's a course for 3 months, then we're going to resettle them. We have to change the calculus of the individual refugee or the household of refugees so that they say, we'll stay here a little longer.
I'm Tamara Keith. You're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Over email, we have something of a devil's advocate question that I want to toss to Fran first. Kevin writes, how is the fence Hungary has built different from the wall between the U.S. and Mexico? Though I don't know that there actually is a wall. And why should hardworking taxpayers have to finance migrants?
I'm not sure that there is a huge amount of difference, except that in Europe there is much more of an open borders. But the Serbian-Hungarian border is actually the border of the EU and of what's called the Schengen area, which is the area of free movement of people that Ambassador O'Sullivan described. It was seen as contrary not to law, but to the way Europeans approach these issues, if I can put it that way.
So to spirit rather than to
yes,
law.
Yes, yes.
And there are other, really other border walls that have gone up. Mm-hmm. 3 years ago, Greece created a wall between Greece and Turkey in Thrace. It worked so well that everybody, the whole traffic, was rerouted to the Aegean. Then the Bulgarians and many other Europeans who objected to that, they extended that wall in order to protect themselves. Yeah. And, of course, the Israelis have massive walls, long walls, you know, in their borders. So whether it makes sense or not, how efficient, how effective, et cetera, the fact is that people do those things.
I would also point out that Serbia is seen as, it is now a candidate country to join the EU. And so this is like saying, okay, we're putting up a wall against those who are soon to join our family. And so That was not good politics, and we're right at a key moment with the Serbs, with the Serbian government, in trying to convince them that they should undertake some very difficult reforms in order to become a member of the EU. And then what do? You put up a wall that keeps all these refugees and migrants in Serbia. It's the politics of it in terms of internal EU
European
politics is difficult.
I want to go back to the phones and Edit in Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah, I appreciate you calling in. So you just recently returned from a volunteer trip to Hungary, is that right?
Well, I am Hungarian. My name is Edith Frenyo, and I'm doing a PhD at Georgetown University Law Center on migration, and I spend my summers in Hungary. So I just recently returned this yesterday, and I spend much of my summer volunteering in Budapest in particular, hands-on with the refugees and migrants, mainly at our train stations, which have turned into makeshift refugee camps, essentially.
And what are you hearing from people?
So the reason I called is that it's very difficult. It seems that the country in many ways has split into two parts. You know, one side, as was mentioned, is sort of following, but there is a great deal of lack of information and an inhospitable attitude towards these migrants, because government narrative has been since early spring that we are going to be, you know, sort of under siege by a flow of economic migrants who are coming here for predominantly economic and labor market reasons. Therefore, when people did start arriving in large numbers, and by now we're talking about over 2,000 people crossing our border into Hungary each day.
Every day.
Every day. And these refugees, so when I'm, you know, out there working with them, the demographics are as following. The majority are Syrians. The overwhelming majority are Syrians. The second largest group are Afghanis. Then there are Iraqis, and then sort of the fourth largest group would be Pakistanis and Bangladeshis mixed, and then a few Africans, and everybody else is behind these large groups. So if we're just starting with the Syrians, Afghanis, and Iraqis, clearly it's a situation of people who would qualify for some kind of protected status, whether a refugee under the convention or other sort of temporary protected statuses. But by the time these people started arriving in such large numbers, the Hungarian public believed, according to the propaganda, that we're talking about economic migrants who are coming here to take our jobs. This is a very understandable and common narrative. We're very familiar with this in the United States as well. The fence, as many of the, you know, callers and other experts mentioned, is also not a unusual phenomenon, unfortunately.
Edit, I hate to interrupt you, but we are running out of time in the show, and we so appreciate your call and what you've contributed. But we are, the clock is winding down. I want to thank our guests, Francis Burwell from the Atlantic Council, and Dimitrios Papadimitriou from the Migration Policy Institute of Europe. I'm Tamara Keith. Oh, Fran, you want to say something very quickly?
No.
Okay. I'm Tamara Keith from NPR News, sitting in for Diane Rehm. Thank you so very much for listening.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkert, Denise Couture, Rebecca Kaufman, Lisa Dunn, Alexandra Boti, Susan Casey, Danielle Knight, and Allison Brody. Our web producer is Erica R. Hendry. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Natalie Yurev Livker answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, and podcasts. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.